Advanced Greenfield Products LLC. And because we have the cross appeal here, Mr. Wallen, you can go first. Then Mr. Collins, you can respond and also present your initial argument on the cross appeal. Then Mr. Wallen, you can do responsive argument on your on the cross appeal and rebuttal on the principal appeal, and then Mr. Collins' rebuttal on the cross appeal. And how you split up the time between your the two parts that each of you have is up to you. Mr. Wallen, you may proceed.
Sure. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Todd Wallen. May it please the Court, Todd Wallen on behalf of Marco Crane. There are two issues on Marco Crane's appeal. The main issue is the reduction in its product liability award based on comparative fault determination. Greenfield admits in its briefing that its defense in this case was contributory negligence. And it's right to do so, because unlike a lot of states where comparative negligence has replaced contributory negligence, that's not Arizona. Arizona retains contributory negligence as a substantive defense. The only change with the adoption of comparative fault is the effect of a finding of contributory negligence, which changes it from a absolute defense verdict to a matter of apportionment. And there's actually a good discussion of that in a Arizona appellate case, Franklin versus Clement, 382 Pacific 3rd, 802, where the court talks about, you know, the relationship between comparative negligence and contributory negligence and states, quote, comparative negligence is not triggered until a jury determines that contributory negligence exists. Thus, the existence of contributory negligence is a prerequisite to the exercise of comparative negligence and the exercise of apportionment. The defense here is undisputedly contributory negligence. And the problem for Greenfield is that Arizona statute 12-2509B expressly provides that there is no contributory negligence as a matter of law in product liability actions in Arizona. So Greenfield's defense here does not exist, and it should not have been entertained below. Now, Greenfield seems to suggest that Arizona statute 12-2506, which talks about apportionment of fault, somehow nullified 12-2509B because 2506 requires apportionment of, quote, fault among all tortfeasors, and fault is defined to include contributory negligence. But that reading of the statutes just isn't right. Under 12-2509B, there is no contributory fault to apportion in a product liability case. Oh, the reference to
under Jimenez, would there still be a defense of product misuse? Now, maybe that's a high standard, but would that still be a defense despite
there could have been defenses.
2509B?
Yes, Your Honor. There could have been defenses for product misuse or for assumption of the risk. Neither was established in this case, but those are the only common law defenses to product liability in Arizona. Contributory negligence falling outside of product misuse, which is unforeseeable use of the products, or knowledge of the defect and then use of it anyway, is barred under Arizona law. It's just not a defense.
But then what do you make of the broad definition of fault in 2506, which lists a lot of things in addition to misuse?
Yeah, well, it does reference, don't really, has any applicability here potentially, is the reference to contributory negligence, because that's what we're dealing with, is contributory negligence under Arizona. It's just what the plaintiff did, how they contributed to their own injuries. And Jimenez addressed that, they addressed the interaction between 2506, the comparative fault statutes, and 2509B at page 687 of the opinion. Jimenez, quote, the statute expressly prohibits a reduction in damages for a plaintiff's contributory negligence in strict liability claims and allows such a reduction in negligence claims. The language in 2506F is merely brought to incorporate contributory negligence where a defense of contributory negligence is possible, such as in a negligence act, it does not mean that the statute supersedes or nullifies a statute in the same section of the Arizona statute 2509B. And the Arizona Supreme Court has made that clear. So this court needs to look no further than 2509B to conclude that the reduction of Marco Crane's product liability damages below was erroneous. Nevertheless, I'd like to address some of the cases or the cases relied on by Mr. Collins, which are primarily Zurn and Bernal. Actually, I dealt with Bernal quite extensively in my briefing, so let me focus on Zurn for a second. That was a rear-end collision.
Before you leave that question, I'm just the broad literal reading of 2509B that you're adopting, wouldn't that eliminate product misuse as a defense too?
No.
Because it says, except that contributory negligence, as distinguished from assumption of risk, is not a defense to a claim alleging strict liability in tort, including any product liability action. So,
Ryan, I think that, I mean, that was the entire issue in Jimenez. And the Jimenez court went to great lengths to say, no, misuse is not contributory negligence. Just like it's always been at common law, they've been sort of viewed separately.
And it survives this language.
And a proportionate.
And they said it survives that language in 2509B, correct?
Right, because it doesn't say product misuse is not a defense. In fact, the Arizona statutes, there's a product liability section that expressly, 682 and 12-683 expressly tell you what the recognized defenses are to product liability. 682 adopts the common law defenses such as assumption of the risk. It would also adopt product misuse. 683 lists four defenses to product liability that are added under the statutory scheme. And they are state-of-the-art product misuse, which was a common law thing and now is also a statutory thing. I think there's alteration or modification of products. And then the fourth is excessive use of something like a food product where it's safe in a certain quantity, but not when you, you know, the poison is in the dosage kind of thing. Those are the recognized defenses. The defense here of contributory fault, no matter how it's, you know, phrased or characterized, is not listed as a defense in the Arizona statutes. And 2509B expressly excludes it. So, now getting back to Zurn, why Zurn doesn't apply? I mean, Mr. Collins suggests that it's controlling here, but that case was a rear-end collision where an intoxicated driver slammed into the plaintiff. The plaintiff only brought a crashworthiness product claim against Ford, the designer of his vehicle. Ford tried to assert that the intoxicated driver was partially at fault and to apportion damages between the two of them. And it was allowed to do so, and the damages came back apportioned 70-30, 70 for the intoxicated driver. And on appeal, the plaintiff suggested that apportionment's not proper because the sole focus is on whether or not this product was crash-worthy, and they should have anticipated, you know, drugs crashing into me. The appellate court in Arizona and Zurn looked at the statute 2506 and said this plainly applies comparative fault to all tortfeasors, whether they're parties or not the action.
But isn't it,
basically
isn't it,
told the plaintiff.
Isn't it very odd, though, then, I mean, given that result, that if, you know, if the accident is, you know, partly the fault of the defective product and partly the fault of, you know, a third party who's drunk, who may be judgment-proof, you only get the part that was the fault of, you're only effectively going to be able to recover the part that was the fault of the manufacturer. But if it was partly the fault of the defective product and partly your own fault, then you get 100%. That seems very odd. So how do you account
for that? To the contrary, though, if you were allowed to get a complete recovery against the manufacturer in that in CERN, you could sue the intoxicated driver, make a recovery for, say, 60% of your damages, and then sue the manufacturer for 100%. It can't be that, you know, the other way around. The point of product liability law is to, A, increase the burden on the manufacturers by imposing strict liability on them. They don't have to be negligent. And B, to maximize the consumer's recovery by taking away contributory or comparative negligence on their part. And the Zurn result does not undermine those policies, because if the plaintiff wanted to make a full recovery, what the courts basically said is sue the intoxicated driver too. You don't get a double recovery by suing and getting a bunch of money from the intoxicated driver and then hold the manufacturer to complete liability. And the same thing happened in Bernal. So it makes perfect sense under Arizona law. Now, I'd also like to address the idea that the contributory negligence is limited to a failure to discover a defect or protect against its possibility. And while that is definitely in the case law, particularly the Miller opinion, I see I'm kind of running low on time. I want to focus on this issue, if that's okay. Real quick. That phrase can be victimized by semantics, okay? And a good example is Justice Bartone's the scenario that he states in his concurring opinion in Jimenez at page 872 of the Pacific Reporter. And he says, suppose a plaintiff mishandles a gun at a firing range. He is not careful about where he points it, but the safety is on. Suppose further that because of a product defect, the safety does not work and he's injured. Plaintiff's conduct is contributory negligence. Now, there are a couple ways to look at this scenario. You could say the gunslinger's negligence was just in being not careful about where he pointed the gun. But that's only so if the safety's not working. Now, you could also say that he didn't protect against the possibility of the safety. Either way, it's contributory negligence. It's just a matter. So the same thing can be said here. You know, Mr. Collins says that Mark Crane's driver was careless in driving at an unreasonable speed, but unreasonable for what? There was no showing that he violated any speed limit. There was no showing that of a reasonable commercial standard that he breached when he accelerated 15 miles an hour after coming out of the turn. It's only unreasonable in light of the fact that dolly is defective. It's the same thing as Justice's scenario. And it's just not a defense to. So you can call it carelessness, or you can call it failure to protect against the possibility that dolly will tip once you hit 12 miles an hour, which is what the experts said. This is classic contributory negligence. It's not a defense to product liability. The Englehart opinion also says that, you know, all you have to do is, they determined that intoxicated driving was not a defense. They said, it's not assumption of the risk, it's not product misuse, it's contributory negligence, not a defense. You can do the same analysis here as the Supreme Court of Arizona and Englehart, you get the same result. The comparative fault finding should be reversed. If you'd like me, I've run over my time. I'm going to address the prejudgment interest, if you'd like, real briefly.
Well, I guess I have one question on that, which is, if we were to agree with you that some portion of the award reflects liquidated damages, what is the date on which interest would begin?
The trial court's going to have to go back and determine when they were incurred. That would have to be remanded to ask the trial court to find out when they were incurred. The problem here is that the court said, I can't figure out why the $603,000 verdict came back at all. It doesn't make any sense to me based on the evidence. And B, I can't tell if there's unliquidated damages here, so I'm not going to award anything. Well, the glaring problem with that is there's three glaring problems. One is that prejudgment interest is a right, matter of right in Arizona. Second is that all parties agree that only about $323,000 were proven as unliquidated damages, leaving about $279,000 was clearly liquidated in this verdict. So we're entitled to something. And the third thing is that under Arizona law, very clearly, once the verdict is entered, any unliquidated damages become liquidated. So I would argue that we're entitled to our you know, the amount of liquidated damages that the jury determined up to the date of the verdict, and that we're entitled to the full verdict amount after the date of the verdict until the amended final judgment is in. And, you know, in terms of whether it should be 279 or 603, I think, you know, what we're having is we got victimized by this comparative fault instruction that was faulty. It not only knocked down our recovery substantially, it knocked down prejudgment interest altogether, which is our right. The fact of the matter is that the jury arrived at that figure, and I'm almost 100% certain, by taking the gross damages figure, which was over $1 million, I forgot, I got it in a footnote in my brief, and multiplied it by 0.57. They applied the comparative fault themselves. It comes up to the dime.
You have raised that mistake before us, even though it does seem pretty odd, doesn't it?
Right. And so what I'm saying is I'm not asking for an editor. I do think it's really terrible that we got hit with that comparative fault thing twice when it should never have been given, because then the court then deducted another 43%. But the fact of the matter is we have a right to prejudgment interest in which you recover as much as the evidence will allow. The evidence here, the jury did that, and they intended to award all of our liquidated damages, which comes just under the $603,000 award. It's like $603,400-something.
Well, if we were to agree that there was a legal error on the issue of comparative fault, what would be the remedy for that? That be remanded to be resorted or retried, or what's the remand you want?
No, Your Honor, I think that the case just needs to be remanded with instructions to the district court to A, remove any comparative fault deduction from the final judgment, enter the full $603,523.67 that the jury found on product liability, to then go back and award prejudgment interest on these slightly less amount of liquidated damages that the evidence supported and that wasn't even contested. Find when those hard damages were incurred, calculate at 10% what the prejudgment interest is on that up to the date of the verdict, October 23rd, 2020, and then award all of our damages, prejudgment interest on the entire verdict, 700 and something thousand, from the date of the verdict until the date of the final judgment. That's it.
Do you want to reserve the rest of your time?
I guess, yeah.
Can I ask you just one quick question, Al? What's the total amount that's at issue in this appeal? Is it $1 million?
Well, that's a good question. It's probably $500,000. I would say. I think the deduction for comparative fault was $200,000 or $300,000. I think we have roughly the same amount in prejudgment interest.
It doesn't make. I have never understood how it paid to litigate a federal case over $500,000. It just strikes me as
The total damages in the case, or the total amount that we're disputing on this appeal?
The amount that you're disputing on the appeal is I'm trying to get at. Why isn't this a case that should be settled and that should at least go to mediation? I mean, it just strikes me that it isn't. It's costing money to. Well, you're probably working on a contingency, but it's costing, it's still taking you time and effort, and there's an element of risk, and of course it's costing the defendant money. It just strikes me as this is the kind of case that should be settled or at least mediated.
I've wondered that myself, Your Honor. I don't have an answer for it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said I've wondered that myself, and I don't have an answer for it. It's a decision of the owners of the two companies.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the total amount at issue in the case was $1,058,813.46. That's how much we've ordered. So.
Thank you. Mr. Collins?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. Jeff Collins on behalf of Defendant Appellee and Cross Appellant Greenfield Products. May it please the court. I'm going to start by addressing the comparative fault argument and ask that the court affirm the district court Judge Snow's decision to allow the jury to consider the comparative fault in this case as it did quite thoroughly. The finding was verdict finding was 57% fault on my client, 43% on the plaintiff's, the plaintiff's driver, Chad Wall. So we're almost dealing with a 50-50 split here. But many courts is that in an injury case or a property damage case like this, that fault be apportioned to parties, non-parties, and fault is defined. And fault is defined in 122506F to include negligence in all of its degrees, contributory negligence, assumption of the risk, strict liability, breach of warranty, etc.
Why is the better reading of that language that the legislature is just saying that any of these types of faults, the whole lot of them, that might be applicable on the substantive law that's relevant should be taken into account? That seems to make more sense than to say that in this definition they meant to alter the underlying substantive law that might apply to particular types of claims.
It
does not seem to support the latter reading.
I think that's correct, Judge Collins. And, you know, the clear intent of the statute was that in injury and property damage cases like this, the fault, no matter what its specific name or designation or legal theory, be considered and fault be apportioned accordingly based upon
but
that.
But only as applicable.
Judge Collins, I think we're asking basically the same question.
But only as applicable. Jimenez says the only defenses that are applicable to a claim of strict liability are misuse and assumption of risk. So to read 2506 as kind of overruling that substantive limitation on what defenses are available and saying, you know, we look at any type of fault that even if it doesn't fit into one of the traditional categories, and not sure that's a correct reading of that language.
Well, the legislature adopted that language, Judge Collins, as part of its legislative intent to so find that juries like this one may apportion fault in any of its degrees to the party. What I'd like to do is address really the primary issue the plaintiffs are making, which is the sort of carve out, if you will, in 12-2509. Jimenez addresses it head on, and I think what Jimenez says is important. Jimenez says we read 12-2509 only as a badly worded but successful attempt at preserving the common law rule that contributory negligence is not a defense in strict liability. That's Jimenez 904, second at 867.
How does that language help you?
Well, that leads, thank you, Judge Corman, that leads to the question of what was the Arizona common law rule regarding contributory negligence in products liability that was a badly worded attempt at preservation? In order to find that, Judge Corman, in your honors, you have to look back at the case law, and that starts with Miller versus State Lane even prior to. And contributory negligence as defined by those courts has been confined to the failure to discover the defect. In Miller versus Stapley, the court held contributory negligence of the plaintiff is not a defense when such negligence consists merely in a failure to discover the defect in the product. That's not what we have in our case. According to Jimenez, that the failure to discover.
I don't understand that language to it just says what you just said in the context of that particular case.
Correct, Your Honor. In that case, is an example, and I'm going to discuss Jimenez as well, Judge Corman, that Arizona courts have narrowly defined what the phrase contributory negligence means in strict products liability cases, and that is the failure to discover a defect. So when Jimenez talked about a badly worded statute trying to preserve the common law rule of contributory negligence, it's talking about preserving only that, which is the failure to discover a defect.
You agree, though, that what is an issue here is not, does not rise to the level of product misuse.
That's correct, Ms. Collins. Again, when we're talking about what Jimenez was talking about, a badly worded statute preserving the common law rule of contributory negligence in Arizona, courts addressing contributory negligence have limited to the failure to discover that defect, which means something other than that, like we have in this case, which is the improper driving, is subject to 12-2506 and that's effectively what the court in Bernal said, and I'll get to that.
That I don't understand that last step, because the common law rule before this statute was that the kind of defense you're making was simply not available, right? I mean, if it weren't for the statute, if you're just looking at the common law rule, you could not make an argument based on contributory negligence of the sort that you're making, could you?
Well, you could try, Judge. Unfortunately, it was never addressed head on, but as deduced by the court in Bernal and even in CERN somewhat, those courts considering contributory negligence in Arizona in this context have really confined it to the failure to discover the defect.
What they meant by saying that is that's the only kind of contributory negligence defense that exists. Other kinds of contributory negligence like simply aren't available, right? That's what Jimenez says. It's just not applicable to strict liability, right?
Well, that may be the case, Your Honor, but when you're talking about 2509, if 2509 carves out what was previously recognized, 2506, the Act itself opens the possibility for all degrees of negligence. And 2509 simply just carved out what was previously recognized, which is the failure to discover the defect. Jimenez itself said the failure to discover the defect in the product which plaintiff should have discovered is contributory negligence. And then further, contributory negligence is not applicable in strict liability because the duty rests on the ultimate, because the duty rests upon the ultimate consumer or user to search for the defect. So, Bernal, this is how Bernal got to its ultimate decision. Bernal discussed, the district court judge discussed the history of Arizona law regarding contributory negligence in a product case. And the court specifically held that Jimenez would likely be limited to the narrow definition of contributory negligence it adopted, and the Arizona Supreme Court would apply the comparative fault scheme of 12-2506 in a case such as this. That's the point with regard to how Arizona courts have looked at contributory negligence. And that's the point that the district court of Bernal and said that.
What exactly do you claim was the product? Was the claim that it was the product was defective and that should have been discovered?
No, Your Honor, we're not. I'm sorry, Judge Coleman. We are not. We have not alleged contributory negligence that it should have been discovered. The comparative fault issue, the contributory negligence in this case, which the jury assigned 43% to Mr. Wall, was his improper driving around a 120-degree supercar with a heavy crane and a boom dolly. So Bernal sums it up, Your Honors, in the district court there predicting what the Arizona Supreme Court would do, which is apply the narrow definition of contributory negligence recognizing, and that as in the other case laws, and 2509 applies to that only, and therefore adopt the comparative fault scheme of 12-2506 in a case like that. And a case like that is a case like this, which is dealing with improprieties in driving. And I think Judge Miller made a good point earlier. It doesn't make any sense. For example, the example I was going to raise, if you have a one-car accident into a tree, and there is an allegation that a defect caused the car to go off the road into the tree. If another person was driving, the plaintiff would be able to assign fault to that other person based upon Zurn. But if the plaintiff, he or herself, were driving, the defendant would not be able to claim that contributory negligence. And that doesn't make sense. Bernal is a perfect summary of the case law of the state, distinguishing how Jimenez and Miller don't apply. And as Judge Snow did in this case, properly applied 12.506. And for those reasons, we believe that Judge Snow's decision to allow the comparative fault instruction should go to the jury, which obviously they consider wholeheartedly in assigning 43% of the fault to Mr. Walford's driving. We do take issue, Your Honors, with the position of Marco Crane that if this court disagrees with the giving of the comparative fault instruction, that this case be remanded for a trial. This isn't a case in which it was a 99% fault to my client and a 1%. Like I said, this was almost 50-50. next issue on our cross appeal unless any of the court has additional questions regarding the comparative fault issue.
I guess I didn't word my question correctly. What was the basis for the strict liability claim? In other words, you say contributory negligence contributed, but what did it contribute to?
Thanks, Judge Corbin, I apologize. The Marco Crane allegations with regard to defect serve were that the, I don't know if Your Honor is familiar with the boom dollar, but it's basically a small cart that goes behind a large crane and holds part of the boom. That was manufactured and designed in such a manner that it was prone to tipping over. That was the general allegation, Your Honor. And at the time of the accident, Mr. Wall was going what everybody deemed a super turn, which was a 125-degree turn, and as Judge Snow found in his post-trial rulings, there was ample evidence in front of the jury based upon expert testimony stating the degree of that turn that the jury's apportionment of fault was supported by the evidence.
I think you were about to turn to the cross-appeal, and can I start you out there with a question on it? On the evidence of other accidents, suppose that we agree with you that the district court misunderstood the law and that evidence of other accidents can only come in if the other accidents are substantially similar. In your brief to us, you haven't really developed the question of, were these other accidents in fact dissimilar? So I wonder if you could address that, and because I'm having trouble seeing, even if we agree with you on what the law is, how can we reverse without some showing that in fact the evidence, the accidents weren't similar?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Unfortunately, and I'm not sure if this answers Your Honor's question, but unfortunately, Judge Snow scheduled a full evidentiary hearing on numerous pretrial issues in which this kind of evidence was supposed to be set forth with specificity. What was intended to introduce a trial, and we would discuss each of these accidents individually. That did not occur. At trial, despite my objections, testimony was allowed vaguely concerning similarity. So when we tried to raise the opportunity to pretrial evidentiary hearing on the motions to eliminate, Your Honor, after full briefing, that was the time for that to be flushed out. And unfortunately, there really was no evidence other than using those words of similarity at trial. And you have to understand, Judge Miller, and Your Honors, that all of these accidents involving or other accidents involving these boom dollies are extremely factually specific with components.
The eliminate ruling involved a degree of deferring the issue to later. And did you renew specific objections as things developed out at the trial to sort of tee up the discrete issues as they were presented?
I did, Your Honor. And I know this is an issue that the appellant has raised with regard to potential waiver on some of these issues. And I did make foundational objections that set forth in the record and in our reply brief. That when these folks were getting ready to testify regarding specifically plaintiff's expert Travis Wells, that I objected with regards to foundation hearsay and relevance and was overruled, at least to the extent of those objections that set forth out in my pleading, my brief, Your Honor, and in the record. The primary problem with the other evidence is that if the court, Judge Snow, directed us to follow the Cooper case involving dissimilar accidents, then Cooper was limited to dissimilar prior accidents. And unfortunately, in this case, there was significant testimony about a few other accidents, Biggie and Bragg, which postdated Hinch. Number one, there wasn't foundation to prove substantial similarity in those. And number two, if the judge was admitting them under Cooper, that they were post our accident and therefore inconsistent with the reasoning of Cooper, which was to allow impeachment of an expert if the expert testifies the product is safe, and the reason being that if their accident prior to your accident, then perhaps conditions which were allowed.
Well, what's the relevant sense in which similarity has to be shown? What makes it similar and what makes it dissimilar for relevant purposes?
Well, I think, Judge Collins, that would probably apply on a case-by-case basis given the facts, and that's why I was trying to explain earlier in the facts of this case, when you're dealing with a heavy piece of machinery, and then you're dealing with a boom dollar, and you're dealing with a driver, and you're dealing with road conditions, that there has to be some substantial similarity and a combination of those factors as to how the accident occurred. It's not enough just to say that accident involved a boom dollar tip over, and this one did as well. They're similar. There are way more.
Well, but if the claim is that if it had been designed a particular way, tip overs won't happen, and the absence of that feature led to the tip over, does it matter the particular circumstances that then of the accident that produced the tip over that would have been prevented by an alternative design of it?
I think it does, Your Honor, because, I mean, obviously no boom dolly is designed to withstand any speed at any super turn. I mean, this boom dolly was not designed for somebody in Mr. Wall's shoes to drive around 123 turn at 60 miles an hour. That didn't happen here, and that would be an absurd example, but there's no standard requiring that this boom dolly be designed to withstand any circumstances, road conditions, driver activity.
What do you suggest would be the remedy? Would we send it, if we agreed with you, would we send it back for the judge to have a hearing initially on the similarity issue?
I think, Judge Corbin, that's the case. Yes, there'd have to be an evidentiary, but improper evidentiary hearing with regard to substantial similarity, and only allowing those that meet that foundational basis to be admitted during trial. And if there's admission of dissimilar accidents, it may be limited to the pre-existing or pre-Marco Crane accident only.
I
see that I'm out.
You're appealing a decision to let in the evidence, right? And the decision to let in the evidence was only wrong if, in fact, the evidence was of accidents that were not similar. So in order to get relief from the Court of Appeals, isn't it your burden to show that the accidents weren't similar, and which is part of showing that there was some error?
Well, Your Honor, I think, Your Honor, it's their burden initially to show that. And over my objection, that evidence was admitted at trial. I made the proper, at least as set forth in the record before, Your Honor, the foundational objections at trial to no avail. So their initial burden is to show substantial similarity, and I voiced foundational objections saying they had not done so when it was admitted. And secondarily, Your Honor, there's another error here, that if Judge Snow's purpose as set forth in his pretrial order was to admit evidence of dissimilar accidents to impeach expert testimony that the product was safe, there was error in allowing Biggie and Bragg, the subsequent accidents, to come in, which was prejudicial under Rule 403. I see that I'm out of time this evening, unless the court has any other questions.
We'll give you a little time for rebuttal. Mr. Mullen.
Thank you,
Ron. All right. Real briefly, getting back to the main issue in my appeal, something that Bernal shows how Jimenez is limited in pretty tributary negligence that is a failure to discover a defect. I don't see how that's so, since Jimenez didn't deal with a contributory negligence claim. The most concrete example that was given in Jimenez was Justice Martone's example of the gun, of the guy himself with the gun. That is not classically a failure to discover the defect. The claim there could be phrased by a creative lawyer as just carelessness with the gun in it himself. In reality, though, it's a failure to discover and protect against the defect, because it's only like carelessness if that safety's not working. And that's the same thing we have here. You know, there's no accusation of him breaching any standard of care or driver. What it is he drove at an unreasonable speed, is their claim, given the propensity of that dolly to tip at speeds of more than 12 miles an hour. That is classic, you can call it what you want, the semantic gains. This is classic contributory negligence. It's just not a defense in Arizona. Now, in terms of, I think your honors were right on the other accidents thing. There hasn't been any showing made that there was a dissimilarity. In fact, their representative admitted at least the Biggie accident, which is the main one that he complains about, was similar to ours. And if you look at the Black and Decker case that I cite, I forget which circuit that's out of, all that's required is it's the same product and the same type of injury. That's what we've got here. We've got all W3 dollies. We're not talking about different brands, different models. We're not talking about any of that. They all rolled over. There is no showing, even if he made timely objections, he hasn't met his burden to show that they would, that he did not. I mean, the first objection to this came in after his representative testified about other accidents for pages in the record. And do you think that five accidents is too many? No, it's a personal opinion. I mean, these kinds of, I think, Your Honor, because there were no timely objections to this, you have to look at this from a plain or fundamental error standard, and you have to isolate it so that the instances where he did raise objections, did allowing those questions to go forward, those particular questions, constitute fundamental error? And the answer is no way, no way. This isn't preserved other than for a fundamental error challenge. He hasn't argued or shown fundamental error, and he hasn't shown just even the basis that even if he had made objections, that he would have won them. The appeal is hasn't met any burden.
Is there anywhere in the record where you actually discuss the facts of the prior and subsequent accident?
A little bit, and it started with their own witness at the beginning of trial, talking about how he participated in investigations of other accidents. Yes. Their own witness started off with it, and then they had another witness who testified about it, Josh Myers, without any objections. Their expert testified about the other accidents, and then they presented their argument. Instead of arguing that they shouldn't come into the judge at trial, they argued it to the jury. They accused us of committing a smoke screen, trying to protect them from the issues at hand. They use it for their advantage, and this is precisely what this court held in, I think it was Scott versus Ross. You don't get a second bite of the apple. You don't get to see what the jury's going to do and then come back and complain about it and say, oh, I want another bite of the apple. It's just not proper. They have met burden, and that those aspects of the trial should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Rowland. Mr. Collins, we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Aaron. Sorry about that. Just briefly on the comparative, Judge Snow reached his decision in this case after reading Bernal and applying Bernal. Bernal itself says what it says, which is I've discussed with your honors today in the pleading. I haven't heard anything as to why the reasoning of Judge Snow or the Bernal court is improper as applied to this case in assigning comparative fault to the tune of 43% to this driver. Bernal went through the process of examining the history of the cases before this court and distinguished it and limited those cases and predicted how that judge felt that the Arizona Supreme Court would rule on an issue pretty similar fact that was analogous back here. And therefore, I think our position to Judge Stowe's ruling in that regard was well founded. Briefly, on the remedial issues, there was a subsequent incident. And working in conjunction with that company, there were some modifications made in the testimony as set forth in the record. Those modifications were made to make tip-overs less likely or less likely to occur. Clearly, that was remedial. The only real response from the appellant on that issue was that it was not voluntary. The remedial measures citing an NRA air crash, which involved the FAA report, the Pan Am had to comply with. Clearly, this was voluntary, done in conjunction with Dickey. The second pushback seems to be that it was admissible to impeach witnesses that the product was safe. In the Johnson case, the Arizona appellate court case says you cannot admit that evidence unless it directly impeaches witness testimony, and you must make an exaggerated claim to the witness or the expert that this is the safest possible, which was the example given in Johnson. That's not the case here.
Did you make a timely objection to this in trial, to this remedial argument that you're making?
We believe we did.
As opposed to the, there are two issues here that I suppose they're related. One is the other accidents, and the other is the remedial.
We believe we did, Your Honor, for the reasons set forth in the briefing of the record. And I guess importantly, it's also procedurally important to understand how this happened. This particular issue, as was the other accident, were subject to motions in limine number one and number four. Judge Stone ordered an evidentiary hearing with complete briefing and exhibits and witnesses that Marco Crane was going to introduce on the issue. Didn't happen, at least to the extent that we feel was appropriate. There was court's order 925-20 ruling on these issues that's in the record. And based upon the Hallerman versus Riverside case that we cited, those objections were properly preserved. The subject was explored, and Judge Stone's ruling was explicit. So to answer your question, Judge Corman, yes, we think that they were properly approved preserved both the trial and prior to Judge Stone issued the defendant rulings on those issues prior to.
So I want to be sure that I have the sequence right. My understanding on the subsequent remedial measures part, at least. So you filed the motion in limine to exclude that. The district court said, I'm denying the motion because I think the evidence would be relevant to responding to your state-of-the-art defense, which you then subsequently said, well, we're actually not going to present that defense. But you did not then go back to the district court and say, you know, hey, now that we're not presenting that defense, please reconsider and exclude the remedial measures evidence. Do I have that right?
I think that's generally correct, Judge Miller, notwithstanding any of the trial objections that were raised on the issue set forth the record, but I'm not recalling them if I sit here, but I agree with Your Honor, there certainly was nothing more formal than that that I think answered the question.
Thank you very much. Thank both counsel for their helpful arguments this morning, and the case is submitted. And that concludes our calendar for the day, and we are adjourned until tomorrow.